So computing systems at perimeter. At perimeter, we have what we call a multi-tiered strategy for setting the needs for computing powers for the researchers here. At the lowest tier, individual researchers, such as you, get laptops or desktops, and you can use them and you run Mathematica and LaTeX and Word there as usual. And then if your laptop is not fast enough, then there we have what we call a scientific computing environment that is essentially a set of high-powered shared workstations where you can log in and run calculations if your laptop is not large enough. I demonstrated that with Mathematica. I ran a remote kernel on a system on compute, and you should be able to do that right away from your laptop if you know how to configure Mathematica that way. And if you don't know how to do that, you can ask your colleagues, ask the help desk, or ask me for assistance with that, even in the future after this lecture is over. These shared workstations are used with remote access. That means there's no keyboard or screen or something you could sit in front of, but you would use that remotely. You could use something like a remote desktop on Windows, or probably secure shell and bash and PuTTY or whatever the command is called under Windows to access these systems. And the next tier, if these shared workstations are not large enough for you, then a small high-performance computing system that we have at perimeter. I'm going to have another slide on that. And if that is not large enough, then there are computing systems available in the province of Ontario or shared across all of Canada. And I can provide help and support if you need access to these systems. Probably need permission from a faculty advisor or from a collaborator to get access to these systems. But these are some of the world's largest supercomputers if you work on a research project and you need access to these. And the local consortium that runs high-performance computers is called SharkNet. That's all over Western Ontario. And one of the largest installations is actually at the University of Waterloo, just 10 minutes from here. This is me introducing myself again at the end of the week. Research technologies. If you do research these days, you probably need some kind of technology, laptops, Mathematica, and so on and so forth. So my role at Perimeter, I'm a research staff member here. My role at Perimeter is to be a liaison between the IT department that supports all the infrastructure and the researchers that want to use the computers for their research. I have a background in relativistic astrophysics. I simulate black holes. So I do the large numerical simulations that I'm going to show off later in the lecture. And of course, the IT team is supposed to support the needs, provide the laptops, Mathematica licenses, and so on and so forth. So if you have questions regarding software, regarding infrastructure that is needed, then after you're welcome to come to my office or to ask me via email. There's a particular help desk. You can send help requests to help at Perimeter Institute or consult at Perimeter Institute or simply come to my office, Office 350. The scientific computing environment that I mentioned on the first slide, we consists currently out of 7 workstations, very large, high-powered workstations, modern fast processors, a lot of memory. The first one is called Compute. The others have named Compute 1 to Compute 6. There are no rules regarding access. You can just log in. I mean, if you're familiar with Unix and SSH and so on, pick one that is currently not overused and run some simulations there. You're not supposed to hog all of them. If you really need a lot of computing power, then you should move over to the next tier, the high-performance computing system. But if you need to run something, a remote Mathematica kernel or something that you compile yourself in C, Python, Fortran, you can just go there. They're running Ubuntu. There are many research-related Ubuntu packages installed. And there's also a lot of custom software available, software packages that some of the researchers here use. I don't list them here. There's one workstation called NVIDIA that has a GPU built in, if you're interested in GPU computing. And I mentioned the other things already. This is some of the software packages that are available there. Obviously, Mathematica, Maple, MATLAB, Magma, and Sage. Sage is one of these open source competitors to Mathematica and Maple. Python compilers, CUDA, OpenCL, RNPL is a rapid numerical prototyping language that's used in numerical relativity, and some visualization packages. And if you need something particular, feel free to ask for something. Maybe it can be installed there for the benefit of everybody. The high-performance computing system is really small. It consists of about 30 nodes, which is actually quite small by today's standards. It's called Titan. you would log into a front end and you can't access the actual compute nodes directly. There's a batch system, which is quite inconvenient because it means you can't use a graphical user interface such as you like to use with Mathematica. Instead, you have to write a script and then you submit the script to a queuing system. Whenever a set of nodes becomes available, as many nodes as you need, your script will execute there and then you get the result back. It's like computing in the 1970s when you would write your program and give it to the system administrator. Next morning, you get the result back. And of course, if there's an error in the program, you know about the error the next morning and then you have to try again. This is really, really frustrating and time consuming. It's a big impediment for people starting to use high performance computing. There's a big difference between people using individual workstations, which basically everybody is able to do, and using supercomputers. There's a big barrier of entrance because the systems are unfortunately quite inconvenient to use. There is a researcher wiki. If you go to my.py.local, then there's a researcher wiki, and on that wiki you can search for HPC or for Titan if you want to know some more of the details, or again, you can ask me. And the researcher wiki is currently being revamped. It's going to be rewritten into what is called a researcher portal that should be easier to use. And last, that may also be interesting for you, if you need to access Perimeter's computing systems from the outside, remote access, there are basically two ways. The first is VPN, virtual private network. I don't know, do you have that installed? Are you familiar with that? No one says anything. That's a piece of software that needs to be installed on your laptop. And you also get kind of an electronic access key. There's also a license on the laptop. And then using the laptop, you can, if you have connection to the internet, it looks to Perimeter as if your laptop was actually physically at Perimeter, logged into the PI resident network. And then you can access all the internal services at Perimeter. For example, my.py.local or the workstations or the HPC system, even if you're outside Perimeter in a coffee shop or at home. And the other way to access the systems from the outside is via SSH. That is, again, something that needs to be specifically enabled for you. So you would talk to the help desk for that, as with having VPN installed. And then you can log into our SSH server that is just called perimeterinstitute.ca. And from that SSH server, you can continue to log into the system that you actually need to use. I'm going to skip this last slide because we didn't talk about shell programming at all. And if you're familiar with that, you may already know how to do that. The basic problem here is you've run something on a remote computer and you lose your network connection, then by default, the remote job is interrupted and aborted and doesn't give you anything. And if you want to use the, say, shared workstations for a large calculation, it may be running for an hour. And if during that hour you lose your network connection, it's very convenient because you have to begin from scratch. And there are ways around that, but they're unfortunately quite complicated. So remote computing isn't as trivial. As it ought to be. Good. Do you have questions regarding this? This was mostly an overview of information that is also available on my.py.local on the researcher wiki. It basically just tells you what is out there so that if you need that, maybe in a year from now for your essays, then you can go back to that information. Okay, very good. Now I'd like to continue then with another presentation. An introduction to simulation science. So simulation science, I want to call that all the different fields of science that you need, that need to come together to be able to perform a large numerical simulation. Yesterday, I introduced you to numerical methods just in a Mathematica notebook. Of course, I only showed you how to do that in Mathematica. I didn't give you any of the physical background of where the equation comes from or of the numerical analysis, the mathematics background. That tells you why it is a good idea, in what sense this converges, how you can estimate the error, how you can prove that it actually makes sense that the error converges to zero. There's a lot of additional science behind that that I didn't even mention yesterday. And if you want to run on a large computer, then you also need, of course, a healthy dose of computer science to be able to use the computer efficiently. And I want to compare using a large supercomputer to using a laptop. It's approximately similar to having a small lab and say an optical bench there where you do quantum computing and it's just a research group and a grad student gets their own part of the optical bench and you can do your research there and you're quite independent and free and do what you want to do. But if you work on such an optical bench, you're not going to discover the Higgs boson. because that requires cutting-edge research that requires large international collaborations, probably billions of dollars, and equipment such as at CERN. And working in a lab for yourself versus working at CERN is very different. Of course, these are really the two extremes. Working at CERN, you're probably spending most of your time either testing or designing, revamping something in committees. There's lots of politics and so on going on. And it is much more frustrating, and progress is really, really slow compared to working on your own lab bench, where if you have a new idea, you can redesign the experiment and get started in another week or two, and it's just a thing between you and your professor. So it's much more fun to work on the lab bench, and you're more flexible, but you're not going to discover the Higgs boson. So you have to find your middle ground. And of course, there is a middle ground, depending, right? I mean, there are also medium-sized experiments. And with computing, it's similar. There's, on the other hand, there's your laptop, your personal research platform, where you can do everything you want with Mathematica notebooks or Python programming and everything. But sometimes you want to use really, really large computers. You need to get to a lot more detail in your numerical methods. And then you would use a supercomputer for that. But they're more difficult to use, require training before you can do something useful there. And you probably need to engage in a collaboration, because if you write a large program, you couldn't do that successfully yourself and have enough time to write papers. So this is a presentation where I just give an introduction in how one would perform large-scale numerical simulations on supercomputers and why it's a good idea and some of the concepts that arise here. Even if you don't do that yourself in your future, you may have a collaborator that does that. So many people at Perimeter, for example, have collaborators at CERN or part of a collaboration that uses CERN. Even if they're just a theoretical physicist working with a blackboard here, you still need to have some knowledge about how such a large collaboration works. And this is the equivalent, except for computational science, not for experimental high-energy physics. So some problems are just too complex to be solved analytically. I think it's quite clear. For example, here I have a crash test, one car crashing into another car, and you want to know exactly what happens, whether the people in one of the cars are safe. And of course, you can't solve that analytically. You can do that experimentally, but it's quite expensive because you actually have to build two cars and then destroy them in the crash test. And modeling in the car in a computer is these days advanced enough that you get good results. You can make predictions that are actually worthwhile for an engineer. And of course, running a computer simulation is cheaper than building a car. It's not actually free, right? A computer simulation, if it takes a significant amount of time with a large computer, can still cost thousands of ten thousands of dollars, but it's still cheap compared to building a prototype car. And this is a simulation where I actually contributed. That's a simulation of two black holes, nicely represented in this visualization by shiny spheres here. So actual black holes are not shiny, and surrounded by gravitational waves. And that's also interesting, because that is something that you can't do in a lab. You can't do an experiment with black holes yet. So if you want to understand that, you have to use a supercomputer. That's computational fluid dynamics. There is a channel. There's water flowing up here. You want to know the flow field exactly in the channel. These are coalescing stars that merge and then disrupt, and there's a cloud of gas forming. And this is probably some kind of airplane wing or some kind of missile wing, and you want to know the stresses and if you want to design that similar to the car design. So why would one use simulations? In some cases, the physical systems are very small. For example, how does the fuel burn in an internal combustion engine, in a car engine? And of course, the burning happens very quickly. It happens within milliseconds. So actually designing an experiment to understand how the flame front propagates in such an explosion in a car engine is very difficult. And in a computer, once you have all the data, once you have simulated everything, it's much easier to understand it and then design a better, cleaner burning of the flame front. And sometimes you want to predict something. When I designed that slide, I was living in Baton Rouge after Hurricane Katrina. So if there's a hurricane in the Gulf, you want to predict where it's going. And that is also something where you can do computer simulations and try to predict the weather. Of course, that's still quite difficult to do. You want to engineer something better in the car crash or in a video game. They also contain a surprising amount of physics. Not quite the real physics. It's more kind of an invented physics, a physics that's more fun for the players. But the simulations that go on in the typical computer game, they are actually physics-based, and they're solving PDEs in there. And it's the same kind of computer science and numerical analysis that you would use for that. So at the black box, this is how it works. You start with the laws of physics or the laws of chemistry or something, and then something magically happens, and then you get output the result of the simulation that looks cool, and you're going to talk about that black box. And one way to do that is that you use two steps. First, you use mathematics to take the original laws of physics, you formulate them in PDEs, you ensure that the PDEs are consistent. You discretize the PDEs, that is, you make some kind of approximations of the boundary conditions. There are certain physics effects they would need to leave out because they're too complex to be modeled. I mean, you may know the exact physics that goes on, but the equations are difficult to solve, so replace them by an approximation. And the second step, once you have the discrete equations, you use a large computer to solve everything. That's quite simplistic. Now, the name supercomputer, the question is, why is it called supercomputer? And the idea that people have there is that it's a computer that's really, really fast. We talked about that yesterday afternoon. People said, oh, we have a supercomputer in-house. It probably has a super fast network. And it's actually not true. The supercomputer is attached to the regular institute network. It's a gigabit network, which is fast by today's standards because this is a modern institute, and then we pay attention to these kind of details. But you would get the same kind of bandwidth from just a fast laptop or a fast workstation attached to the network. So it's not actually that much faster. And a supercomputer, the Titan that we have, has about 30 individual nodes. So if you play a computer game on it, the computer game isn't really parallelized. It could use only one of these nodes. So it wouldn't run faster. It would run as fast as on a high-powered workstation as anything you could buy for yourself at home. So computer games are not optimized. The supercomputer isn't really faster. It's just bigger. It has 30 of these things. It's just like a big ship. And driving a big ship isn't really fun. I mean, it takes years of experience just making sure that you know how to steer and how to brake soon enough, because it probably takes 2 hours for the ship to stop just because it has so much momentum and the engine is so weak compared to the size of the ship. Now, I designed these slides for a computer science class, and of course, some of the content of the slides will be a bit insulting to you because you know all of that, but so I'm going to skip over some of the slides. You of course know that laws of physics can often be cast in the form of partial differential equations that can then be solved. And in layman's terms, if you know the state of the system, for example, you have an initial condition, then the PDE describes how the system changes depending on the state. And then you have a new system state after a small amount of time, and then you continue to iterate through that. That would be a time evolution for, say, wave propagation. You know the pressure and the velocities of the air in this room, and then you can predict how it's going to be in a millisecond, and then you know the pressures and velocities again, and so on. And then you can simulate the sound propagation through this room. Now it bounces off the walls. And then you can find out that the shape of the ceiling is actually good because my sound waves are then reflected down onto you. The people in the back can hear me better. Of course, there's also a microphone. So I'm going to skip over the layman's introduction of how a partial differential equation works. And discretization, that is something that I explained yesterday in Mathematica. If you think about the vector spaces in which functions live, they're infinite dimensional. You can't really represent that in the computer. You want the discretization, you want to reduce that to finite dimensional vector spaces. So you discretize it, or you quantize it, or whatever you want to call it. So you have a continuum system, and then you break the down into discrete pieces. And what I described yesterday is also called a global method, a spectral method, because you represent that via basis functions. There are other methods. In fluid dynamics, for example, you would chop up this room into small individual voxel elements, small individual cells, and each cell you could represent the average velocity and the average pressure, and then you can compare the pressures between neighboring cells, get an approximation for the pressure gradient, and that gives you the forces and would give you an update to the velocity. And there are many different discretization methods that way. The spectral method that I mentioned yesterday is one of them. Others are finite elements, that you would use that for airplane wings, for example. There's finite volumes, the small cubes that I just described here for fluid dynamics. There are finite differences. These equations are good for wave-type equations. For example, in general relativity, that's kind of a wave-type equation simulating black holes. We use finite differences for that. And there are particle methods and many, many more discretization methods that just, in the language that we used yesterday, are different sets of basis functions that we use to describe the equations. And of course, there's a huge amount of literature that goes very far into engineering for how to do these things. And yesterday, I mean, I couldn't even begin to describe all the complexity and all the issues that you have and all the optimizations that people have performed to ensure that the discretization is efficient and accurate and has a low amount of error. The main feature of a discretization is the discretization error. We mentioned, I gave an example yesterday. We used 4 basis functions and repeated the same example with 10 basis functions, and the solution became more accurate. And in that particular case, yesterday 4 wasn't good enough and 10 was good enough. And of course, what you need to have as you use more points, if you use smaller cells, as you increase the number of basis functions, the solution must converge in some sense to the analytic solution so that you can make a prediction about the actual analytic system. And this is called the discretization error. And the basic property is that if you have a higher resolution, then the discretization error goes down. Typically, you have polynomial convergence. That is, the error grows as a certain size of the size of the grid cells, a certain power of the size of the grid cells. And for example, a good convergence order would be 4th-order convergence. If you use grid cells that are half the size, then the error would be reduced by a factor of 16. Actually, in fluid dynamics, people usually get only 2nd-order convergence. And that convergence, of course, is a property of the discretization method. And the basic idea, when you discretize something, first you choose a partial differential equation that describes the system well, that is not too close to the physics, because that would be then probably too complex to solve and not too simple, so that not any of the important physical characteristics are left out. You discretize the partial differential equation, and assuming you want to do some time evolution, you can set up some initial condition. For weather prediction, for example, you need to take satellite images and you have buoys in the ocean measuring the sea surface temperature and wind speeds and wave speeds and so on. It's quite difficult to get the initial conditions for hurricane simulations. And then you put that into a computer. Do you have a question?
Weather systems are chaotic, right? Then how are we able to predict them reasonably accurately?
So if systems are chaotic, that means that if you have initial conditions that are close to each other, they will diverge further and further at a later time. And what you need to do in that time is you can't just predict them for long enough. So hurricane simulations, weather that is chaotic. And one of the problems there is that you can make predictions only a certain amount of time into the future. Hurricanes move quite slowly, so you need to predict the weather for 1 or 2 weeks ahead of time, at least the large-scale features. So there are 2 things that can save you there. First, the small-scale deviations do not really interest you. You know that a hurricane is under a global feature that usually remains there for several weeks, even in a chaotic system. So you may be able to predict the large-scale behavior, even if the small-scale differences, whether the wave breaks now or half a second later, you can't predict that. That's not relevant, because the hurricane can still be predicted. And the other feature is, if you have an initial conditions and you know them to a better degree of freedom, you know them more accurately, you can make prediction that lasts for longer. These 2 things combined, plus the fact that hurricane prediction is actually quite important, that means that people can solve that, can make predictions. But if you look at hurricane tracks 3 or 4 days out, it's basically still a guessing game what happens. I mean, the predictions diverge wildly. It's very unfortunate if you live close to the coast. And in many other systems, for example, car crashes, then you basically know this is conservation of momentum, conservation of energy. It's not really chaotic there, what happens there. There's a bit of chaos in the movement of the air and the turbulence behind the car, but you can average that out and still make very good predictions about what, say, how air resistance works if cars move. And in this case, where you make a time evolution, after setting up the initial condition, you follow the system over many, many time steps. And it's a bit of a problem because, of course, to do one time step, you have to do the previous time step first. So all time steps have to be done one after each other. So if you need to do millions of time steps, you can't do them at the same time by just using a larger computer. You just need to wait until the time steps are done. So some simulations just take weeks or months to perform. And you need a faster computer to make that faster. But supercomputers aren't really faster. They're just larger. So that doesn't really help you there. And simulations can actually have billions of elements of grid cells. Yesterday, we used 4 or 10 basis functions. In real simulations, people can use 4 billion or 10 billion, which, of course, introduces a large management overhead, right? I mean, just the software infrastructure to keep track of everything, just the time it takes to write the solution to disk or to produce a movie, then increases. So basically you have to fight software engineering. It's like working with CERN, where you want to work on your experiment, but instead you have to work on getting enough power to the system and dealing with the government in Switzerland to make sure that the power is available, and you have to shut down the detector in winter because in winter there's not enough power available, or things like that. But there's nothing to do with physics, but they're actually very important if you want to get results out. There's a caveat. Some systems, of course, are not described by PDEs. Other systems, in particular in solid-state physics, quantum mechanics, there you have rather linear algebra, eigenvalue type of systems. They can also be solved by supercomputers. Sometimes you have particle systems. If you make predictions in the financial market, you have stochastic PDEs, which aren't really PDEs either. So it's not all PDEs. There are other systems out there as well. And in quantum mechanics, often you are interested in an equilibrium configuration, kind of in the lowest energy state, for example. You look for the lowest eigenvalue in the current configuration that represents that. And most importantly is that you can't really trust the computation because the initial equations that you put in are approximations to physics. The initial boundary conditions are approximations. Then you introduce a discretization error. And then, of course, comes the human factor. The programs are not perfect. So all the prediction in the end can be quite wrong. It's like when you make an experiment, then you can't really trust the experimental result because so many things can go wrong. You have to put in a lot of effort to ensuring that it all works out. There need to be lots of cross-checks. And as in an experiment, if someone makes a prediction based on a numerical method, then you probably want to have two independent research groups making similar predictions before you begin to believe the result. Oh. Good. This was the first half of my presentation, kind of a general outline of the sciences of how one performs a simulation, more show and tell instead of actually giving you useful knowledge. And what I want to do next is describe the architecture of a supercomputer as it looks from a user's point of view. That explains all the difficulties of how one would actually use a supercomputer and how one programs there. I mentioned this already. Supercomputers aren't really large. Sorry, they aren't really fast. They are large. So this is a speedboat. This is not a supercomputer. This is the Super Tango. This is more of a supercomputer. And if you compare the speed of an individual core in your laptop and in a supercomputer, you may find that your laptop has a faster core than a supercomputer. Because in a supercomputer, you may want to have 10,000 or a million of these cores. And it's easier to put them together to get the cooling right and to connect them via high-speed network if each of the individual cores is not as fast. And that of course, is also a bit disappointing because the first time you use a supercomputer, it actually feels a bit slower than your laptop unless you actually make use of all these. It's like you can compare it to a coffee shop where you either hire one worker that is really, really good and really, really fast, or you hire five people that are probably just mediocre, but in the end, they're getting the job done better because there are five people working on the problem. But of course, if the five people don't interact nicely, then they will step onto each other's toes, and you don't get any benefit from having five people there. Then you could only the output of one mediocre worker corresponding compared to one fast worker. Oh. Okay. The first problem with supercomputers is that usually accessed remotely. The supercomputer at perimeter, it was actually physically located in the building up until a few months ago. And then we ran into problems because it uses quite a bit of power. And the amount of power available to perimeter via the power line from the road is actually limited. So we could either pay Ontario Hydro to upgrade the power line or move the computer to what is called a co-location facility. So our supercomputer is these days actually located in Toronto. But you wouldn't notice, right? Because you use it only remotely anyway. You log in via SSH. You wouldn't know that. Also, heating and cooling is much easier there. You would have to upgrade the air conditioning system just to keep the computer cool. And the co-location facility, that is all taken care of. So supercomputers, Since this one is used in Toronto, you can also use a supercomputer at the University of Waterloo or one in the United States or in Europe, when you probably wouldn't really notice the difference. You have to access it remotely, and that means you probably can't easily get the graphical user interface. And that means that programming a computer is complex. And the other thing is that it consists of several compute nodes that you need to program. You only log in to what is called the head node, which is one computer, one workstation, and then you need to distribute the job onto all the compute nodes using the queuing system. You describe the job to a batch system, and the batch system would then choose a few nodes that are available and run your job there and give you the result back. And that is also quite inconvenient. If you have a large program that you run, it's probably going to produce a large amount of output. You probably are familiar with CERN and have heard talks there about the large amounts of data that are produced by the detector, and that you have to reduce the amount of data in several stages for post-processing. And when you run a simulation, a large simulation, the problem is similar. There's a lot of data generated, and then the amount of data has to be reduced by either leaving out some data or analyzing them at runtime before they actually store to disk. And then you have to use the disk directories, the typical different directory structures available on your laptop. You just put everything onto into your home directory, onto your whatever desktop or documents directory. On a supercomputer, you have to make a distinction between the home directory, which is probably slow, but which is backed up. There's a data directory where you have much more space available, but it's probably not being backed up. There may be even another directory called a scratch directory, where data survive only for a few days or weeks, and then they're automatically deleted, but that could be even larger or could be even faster than the data directory. And that means you can't just write an output file. You have to think about how long you keep the files, where they are located, how large the files are, which is something that you typically don't care about on your laptop. You probably never had to delete any Mathematica notebooks because you're running out of disk space. These days, laptops are just too large for that. But if you use a large computer, you have to think about what data to delete and what not to delete. There's nothing more embarrassing than if you delete some kind of file, and then 3 months later, you can get a referee report that asks for another analysis on you already deleted the data. Shouldn't happen. On the other hand, you can't really keep the data because they may be too large. So it requires a lot of thinking, which, of course, again, that is a problem that doesn't really contribute to producing new physics. The computers have individual compute nodes, and they are connected via a high-speed network. These days, it would be called InfiniBand, and that's a few times faster than the gigabit Ethernet or 10 gigabit Ethernet that's available these days. And the overall architecture of a supercomputer is then hierarchical. Each node has several cores. I don't know, how many cores do you have in your laptops? Probably two cores. Two cores here. I have a high-powered laptop that has four cores, and a supercomputer node may have even more cores. These days, there would be 16 or 32 cores, and then you have 10,000 of these individual nodes combined with each other, and then you get an overall system with a few hundred thousand cores that you need to program. And on my personal scale, everything that has less than 1,000 cores is just a really small, tiny supercomputer. And if you go above the 10,000 cores, that's then when it becomes to be really large. So the system at Perimeter has 300 cores. So it's basically just a training system where you can get your feet wet, start programming, debug your programs, design new algorithms. But if you want to actually do some real calculations, there are systems out there that are more than 100 times as large, where you can get much more computing power. I mentioned this already, batch system. This is how computing looked in earlier days, probably even before the times of a batch system. You can't just run a program. You have to describe it in a batch job, and then the job probably waits until the resources are available. Then it runs. Then you get your result back. There's often also a time limit on a batch job. You can't run longer for 24, 48 hours. If you need to run something that takes a few months, you have to break up the calculation into small pieces and run them one after each other. And as if you're doing your experiments in a lab, then you probably have to keep a lab book to keep track of all the experiments you did, everything that you tried, everything you failed, where you kept the data. And if you use a supercomputer, you then have to use the same thing if you lose large numerical calculations. Because you're going to run multiple calculations, you're going to run them in pieces, they're going to be system failures, hardware problems that have nothing to do with problems in your program, but you need to repeat certain calculations, and it gets quite complex and quite tedious. Mm-hmm. I noticed that I'm just describing all the problems with supercomputing. I'm not getting you actually interested in supercomputing. I like these things because I want to. I'm simulating black holes or neutron stars or general relativistic systems, and that is quite exciting, but they're three-dimensional. You can't make an assumption of spherical symmetry. If two black holes both rotate, if they collide, there is no symmetry in the system. And it's just a very complex problem. So you need supercomputers to solve them, and I find that exciting. That is my research, of course. So I should actually get you excited, and I shouldn't just be describing all the problems that you have with supercomputers. Anyway, good. The next thing is supercomputers are shared resources, so not only you are using them, many people over the world are using them. And as in an astronomical telescope, if you want to get some observation time or some beam time in an accelerator, you have to ask for an allocation on a supercomputer where you describe your project, and the project is then reviewed, and then you receive an allocation. You get a certain amount of CPU hours, a certain amount of computing time that you can use for your project. And so you have to write proposals if you want to use a supercomputer. And it's not actually free. If you estimate the cost of a computer, then it costs about 5 cents, or maybe a bit less or so, to use one core for 1 hour. This is just the cost of buying the system, of building a house around the system, of the electricity for the system, and the electricity for the air conditioning that is necessary to get the heat out of the system again. And then you probably need a bit of maintenance support stuff around that as well. So 5 cents per CPU hour is okay. And a large project, a large allocation these days, could be 1 million or 10 million CPU hours that a research group could use. And then 10 million CPU hours per year, that is like grant for $500,000 per year that you get. So if you write the computer allocation, you're just asking for computer time, but there's actually real money behind that. And if you write a successful allocation, and if there's an international peer-reviewed committee that thinks that you should receive an allocation of 1 million CPU hours, then this is like you receiving an actual amount of money. So it's something that you can then be proud of, or if you don't get, then you may want to mention it in on your, then, I mean, if as a grad student you get such an allocation, you would put that on your CV. Okay. Software installed. Yeah, each of these supercomputers, they don't run just stock Ubuntu or Red Hat because they are custom engineered systems. Some of the software is a bit special and difficult to use. I don't want to go into details here. And in the second half of the introduction to supercomputer, I want to give an introduction to parallel computing. Yesterday, we used the numerical method, but the method wasn't really parallelized. I mentioned that in Mathematica, there's a command parallelize, and there's a parallel table, and probably other parallel commands, and you can start several kernels, and then the task is automatically distributed over the individual kernels, and if you do that, you get the result faster. And if you use a supercomputer, and if you want to learn to make that work efficiently on a large scale, then you can't just do that automatically. So you would have to think yourself about how the load should be distributed and which part of the calculation should be executed by what of the, say, 100,000 kernels that you are then using. This is a bit of an introduction to high-performance computing. The first supercomputer was developed by Cray. The name Cray is still famous. The Cray was called the the first Cray computer was a supercomputer at that time in the 70s, but even your watch these days is faster than the Cray was at that time. So anything you get in an iPhone these days compares to a supercomputer of 10 or 15 years ago. It's just the advance of computing technology. The transistors become smaller. It's much easier to put a lot of computing power into something. So if something was a problem for a supercomputer 20 years ago, then 10 years ago, you could solve it on a workstation. And these days, it is just built into Mathematica. But of course, these days, there are new other problems out there that can't be solved in Mathematica yet. I'm going to skip over that but here's an introduction to MPI programming. If you have individual nodes, you not only need to distribute the tasks onto the individual nodes, the nodes may also need to talk to each other. So if each node of a supercomputer solves a part of the problem, you can't solve it independently. There needs to be some communication between them. The example here is you're simulating an airplane. This is the body of the airplane, a wing, and part of the engine nacelle. And then you would split the overall problem, the individual grid points, the individual finite elements, onto different nodes. For example, the blue one could go to one node, the green one to another node, and the red and the orange ones to another node each. And then each of these nodes would solve the particular part of the system, but they need to communicate that the meshes stay aligned. So for example, if there's a force that moves the green part of the wing upwards, then of course the blue part of the wing needs to be told about that. There needs to be connection between that. Did the green and the blue parts actually interact? And one way to do that, that the software standard for communicating between nodes these days is called MPI, the message passing interface. And the basic idea behind that is that one node can send a message to another computing node, where one workstation can send a message to another workstation, and that this is how the individual programs running on the individual nodes then interact with each other. It's quite low level because, I mean, you have to define your algorithm saying at what time what message needs to be sent to what other node, and that is something that in Mathematica, for example, which is a much higher level programming language, wouldn't really fit into that. Message passing is quite a powerful concept, and it's ubiquitous in parallel computing, and high-performance computing is always parallel computing. So I also want to give some real-life message passing interfaces. So if one person sends a letter to another person, that is something like a message passing. Of course, it's much slower than what happens on a supercomputer. Or text messages on a phone is also message passing. A newspaper is another kind of message passing because that is not one-on-one, but there's one company producing a newspaper, one editor, and that is sent to many other people. That is kind of a broadcasting kind of message passing. There's a Chinese whispers game. I don't know, is that the real English name? Where one person whispers something into the ear of the next person, and then it goes round and round the room. It would be a children's game. And that is also a good example of the problems of message passing. If a message needs to go through many individual stations, then A, it takes a lot of time. Message passing can be slow. And B, there's a problem with reliability, that the message that comes out may not be the message that was originally sent. And of course, if you design a supercomputer, you want to make the messages reliable. And that also requires a bit of a budget with error correction and everything. The basic idea between message passing is that you have one message, you wrap it up, you send it as a parcel, as a packet, to a receiver, and that's different from a phone conversation. In a phone conversation of you watching TV, there's a continuous stream of information coming, and in a phone conversation, you can interrupt the other person while someone is speaking, and in pure message passing, that is not possible. So if you have two individual computer programs communicating via message passing, that's actually a quite limited form of communication. Nevertheless, most of supercomputing is based on this kind of message passing. The main task when you devise a parallel program is that you need to store data, and the data needs to be distributed onto all these individual compute nodes. And it's actually a complex task to distribute the information. The total amount of data that you need to store is probably too large to be stored in an individual compute node. If you have, say, 10 billion grid points, or 10 billion expansion coefficients of your function, then you can't store that in one computer because it would need more memory than the computer has available. So you split it out over the individual nodes, and that requires then communication if you want to access data that is stored on another compute node. Okay. I'm going to skip the slide because it may be too much detail, but this is actually important again. If you have a parallel program, there will always be parts that are not actually parallel. For example, the initialization, the setup, by outputting something to the screen, And Amdahl's law describes the speed-up that you get from parallelizing something if there's a certain fraction of your program that you do not parallelize. For example, if you perform a calculation and this calculation runs in parallel on 1,000 computers, and in the end there's a serial park where you combine all the results and make a movie out of it. And if that is a serial part, then of course it doesn't use all the available computing power. And Amdahl's law is then a graph of the speed up, which is how fast the overall program runs, and the number of processors that you're using for different amounts of parallelism that you find in your program. So let's assume that you have a parallel program where 95% of the program runs in parallel, and there's just a small fraction, 5% in the end, that runs in serial. You have the whole calculation running in parallel. In the end, you're making a small movie of the result. You're creating a graph or something. And that is just 5% of the program, but it still runs in serial. And then let's also assume that you're running on individual 1,000 processors, as it would be here, and 95% is in the green part, and then if you do the calculation, you find that in overall, the program runs only 20 times as fast, even though using 1,000 processors. And the problem, of course, is that the 95% of your program that you parallelized, they run 1,000 times faster, but 5%, they do not run faster because that's the serial part. It's still running on a single core, and 5% is 1/20th of your program. So this is the maximum speed up you can get, 20%. So if you want to run on 1,000 cores and want to do that efficiently, then basically the whole program has to be parallelized. And that is very difficult because it requires re-engineering the whole program. That is a large problem in software engineering. So if you want your program to run 100,000 times faster, which is you would hope if you run on 100,000 cores, which large computing systems these days provide to you, then you basically the whole program needs to be in parallel, and you can't have anything that runs in serial, such as creating a graph on a single core. Okay. Going to skip these two slides. And I want to finish my presentation with a movie. Is it playing? It's not playing? No. OK. So this is a simulation that we performed a few years ago. This is a simulation of two black holes. Of course, black holes in vacuum, of course, are described by general relativity. And if you discretize that, it becomes numerical relativity. So we used a particular discretization method called adaptive mesh refinement, where near the black holes, where the curvature is rather large, where the geometry is distorted, we use many, many smaller grid cells than far away from the black hole. The outer boundary should be at infinity, but it isn't. So this is actually at a finite distance where the domain ends, where we perform our simulations. And we're going to zoom in here. At the moment, you don't see anything. Let me just run the movie instead of just talking. Mm-hmm. Is that what? Oh, no. I stopped the simulation. Ah. This does not play. Oh, no. This is very inconvenient. OK. If you give me a minute. Sorry about this. Hello? No, there you go. Yes, finally. So you see, as you get closer and closer to the black holes, the grid cells become smaller and smaller. This is just zooming in. And these are the individual black holes, and the blue arrows represent the spin. And at the moment, we are just panning the camera around the system. And the field that you see at the bottom, that is called the Laplace function, it is something like the exponential of the Newtonian potential that you would get. But this is general relativity. It's just so this Laplace function is 1 at infinity, and it is 0 near the black holes. Now the simulation begins. And as the black holes move around each other, it's like masses moving around each other in general relativity. In Maxwell's equations, in electrodynamics, you would get an electric field. And here's a gravitational field generated. The simulation stops. Now we're just looking around the black hole. This is This is now the black holes have merged to a single horizon, which initially is quite distorted. That is the gravitational wave pattern that was generated, so spiral waves that are moving outwards. And then the individual black hole rings down, and you see the typical spiral pattern that has been generated. And that here, if you saw these wrinkles there, they were reflections from the outer boundary. They're not physical. It's just because we had the outer boundary at a finite distance, not at infinity. Then the waves actually hit the outer boundary and get reflected there. Shouldn't be there. But I mean, overall, the simulation is pretty good. But it's unfortunate that you see that artifact here in the movie. Let me show the simulation again. So we're zooming in here. And you see, as you get closer and closer to the black holes, the individual grid cells get smaller and smaller because you need a higher resolution there. And yeah, of course, in general relativity, with the singularities inside a black hole, there's also a problem with handling the simulations that these singularities numerically. What we do there is we artificially smooth out the singularities. But since it happens inside event horizon, we know that the information about the wrong physics does not propagate outside of the event horizons. So outside of the event horizon, the information is correct for solving the Einstein equations. Inside these horizons, we don't. You see that the black holes now get closer and closer to each other. They spiral in because they lose energy, because they emit gravitational waves. And their initial common horizon is actually peanut-shaped. But very quickly, it becomes spherical by emitting more gravitational radiation here, that other spiral pattern. Yeah, now up there, that discretization error that you see. So this, of course, is the result of many years of hard work of many people. That wasn't something that I did. I wrote that part that shows the different grid sizes. As you get closer to the center, and actually finding a formulation of the Einstein equations that can be solved numerically is quite complicated. If you just write down the Einstein equations, it doesn't work. You can reformulate them in many ways. You need to ensure that the constraints remain satisfied and so on. You have to choose a gauge condition. You're probably aware of that. You have to find a good gauge condition if you want to solve the Einstein equations there. This is all a very complex task that took many years to solve. But right now, such a simulation is considered trivial. You can do that. I mean, we could do that here on the Titan. We don't need a large supercomputer to do that anymore. And trivial doesn't mean that everybody can do it, but there have been many papers describing the methods. And if a few people get together and spend a few months, then you can code a program that actually solves the system like this. Okay. You like movies? Okay, I'll show you another movie. No, not this one. This is another movie where we also solved the, it's not playing yet. This is actually a supernova explosion. I don't know whether you're familiar with that, but if a star has reached the end of its lifetime, then it runs out of fuel, and then the star collapses because the burning fuel creates pressure in the interior. If that pressure is not there anymore, then the gravitational forces pull the star together, and it collapses onto itself. And what we are simulating here is the center of the star. That's a few thousand, 10,000 kilometers. It's basically iron and iron core at the end of the star, and that collapses and forms a protoneutron star or a neutron star at the end. And the end goal is to simulate the resulting supernova explosion. The star collapses, the shockwave bounces back and should disrupt the outer layers of the star. That happens in nature. It does not happen in computer simulations. But since we actually have observations, it's clear that the computer simulations are wrong. There's one key ingredient that is still missing in the computer simulations, some physical effect that is not being taken into account. And that could be a correct treatment of the neutrino radiations or something similar that is currently still missing these days. And there's kind of a race going on between many different research groups, kind of a race for many years by now, trying to find what is missing there and then being able to accurately predict how a supernova explodes. So what is shown here is the specific entropy. The specific entropy, essentially something like the temperature of the matter. So you see where matter has gone through a shock and has been heated. And in the middle, this is the small part, is the protoneutron star that's a few kilometers diameter. And that is a shock front that has gone around that. There's much material from the outside that is falling in here. And here, there's a shock wave that then heats up the material. And you see that the whole simulation is approximately spherically symmetric, but not quite, because there are small fluctuations that actually, via turbulence and other chaotic effects, lead to non-spherical thing. And then in the end, the system becomes more and more non-spherical. And what should happen at some point is that the shock front propagates outwards and disrupts the star. But there's not enough energy to do that. There's not enough heat deposited there. So this doesn't actually happen. And of course, the most impressive thing about that simulation is the nice visualization. We've been doing these things for many years, but then there was someone who actually knew how to visualize it. Now it actually looks quite a bit more stunning. And such a simulation that actually simulated just a few milliseconds, of course, takes many weeks on a supercomputer. And this is kind of cutting edge research, being able to simulate that. And something that we do different from, I mean, we in the sense of a collaboration in which I participate from other groups, is that we actually simulate the full Einstein equations. We take general relativity fully into account. There's a black hole forming if you continue. And other researchers do this only approximately, because they think that general relativity isn't that important. With Newtonian physics, you can still get the main effects of the explosion. And they're probably kind of right, but still. So at the moment, the camera is just panning around it. Well, if you actually want to simulate the black hole that forms in the center and how matter accretes into the black hole, then, of course, you need general relativity. And then, so that will ultimately be important. Yeah, this is also a nice example of something that starts spherically symmetric. And after some time, it's not symmetric anymore. And it's basically just chaotic effects, turbulence that is amplified, that make it look like this. So where these individual bulbs are located, of course, is completely non-physical. It could be anywhere. If you start with only slightly different initial conditions, it would, in the end, look very different. But the fact that you'd get these kind of shapes, I mean, this typical bulb size after that amount of simulation time, that is probably correct, well, if you trust the simulation. And what we are extracting out of these simulations is a prediction of the neutrino signal, which neutrinos are emitted at how much time. And then you can later calculate how these neutrinos are reprocessed in the other layers out of the star. We're also predicting the gravitational waves that are emitted by the matter moving like this. And once the LIGO gravitational wave detectors are online again and in 2 years or so, maybe these gravitational waves can be detected. And that's, of course, once neutrinos from a supernova are detected, or once gravitational waves are detected, this can be compared to the predictions that people make from simulations. And if the predictions agree, that's then a good sign for the simulations. And if they don't agree, then there's probably something missing in the simulations. But this happens deep inside the star. The whole simulation domain is probably 1,000 or 10,000 kilometers. The size of a star is probably 10 million kilometers. And of course, you can't see inside a star with optical light. So this is all hidden from you, from view. The only thing that one can see from deep from the inside are neutrinos and gravitational waves. So this is an example of a system that you can't study otherwise. I mean, numerical methods are the only way. Because it is 3D and not spherically symmetric, you can't really use any analytic expressions to analyze that. And of course, you can't simulate these systems in a laboratory either, because it's just too hard. Well, no, I mean, the properties of the individual gas elements, the relations between pressure and temperature and gas and so on, of course, you can get that from high energy physics and maybe from experiments you run in heavy ion colliders. And that's an important ingredient for the simulations. But in the end, computer simulations are, in this case, the only way to try and understand supernova explosions and where they come from. Okay, that concludes my presentation today. Do you have questions on computing or more questions on Mathematica? Okay, very good.